The surprise discovery of a structural crack in many of SEPTA's regional rail cars made for a rough commute today. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. SEPTA pulled 120 Silver Liner 5 train cars out of service, leading to delays this morning. WHYY's Laura Benchoff joins us from Suburban Station in Center City, Philadelphia, to offer a look at the afternoon commute and the latest from SEPTA. Laura, what are you seeing at this hour?
Hi, Dave. Well, at this hour, it's definitely thinned out here down from peak at about 5 or 5:30. But earlier today, platforms were jammed thick with people waiting on a bunch of different trains. I counted dozens of delayed trains, and SEPTA agents had to help load people onto cars when they actually did arrive so that people didn't overload them. And today was the first day back to work for a lot of people, so some said delays this morning took them by surprise. SEPTA Assistant General Manager Ron Hopkins gave a rundown of what the morning's commute looked like earlier today.
We added an early train on each of the lines. They were full. So we saw that all the way up through the rush hour, which is what we expected. That's what caused some of the delays. And we did have about six trains that had to bypass stations.
Laura, what's the latest on the structural issue? And perhaps more importantly for commuters, how quickly SEPTA can get those cars back out?
Well, that was at a press conference earlier today, and a few details emerged. You know, we know that this load-bearing beam is cracked, but nothing too concrete about moving forward. SEPTA officials say they're looking into a bunch of issues and ways to fix the problem, the congestion, including leasing cars from other states or from Amtrak, or possibly welding the broken piece. General Manager Jeff Knuppel was on hand at that press conference and said they're still figuring out how to get those Silver Liner 5s back out there.
It all comes down to how much of the fleet could we do a quicker repair with versus do we have to replace these beams on every car.
And, you know, he also said some cars were more damaged than others, and they're still looking into the extent of the cracks, which they say were caused by fatigue rather than some sort of sudden catastrophic break.
Laura, this bunch of issues sounds like it'll take a bunch of money to restore. Is there finger-pointing yet as to who's responsible?
That's a really good question. You know, these cars were built in South Philly by a company called Hyundai Rotem. And, you know, SEPTA officials said at an earlier press conference on Monday, that they're keeping track of costs, but have kind of deferred most questions about what was in the contract with Hyundai Rotem and whether or not they'll be on the hook for this.
There's certainly going to be a long road on this, even beyond once all the Silver Liner 5s are in place, of looking at what happened, who's responsible, and how that will be dealt with.
That's WHYY's Laura Benchoff joining us live from the line from Suburban Station in Center City, Philadelphia. And this note, Hyundai Rotem has not responded to our reporter's request for comment. Now, 5 days post-due, lawmakers in Harrisburg continue trying to craft a fiscal budget. Let's assess the work in progress with Pennsylvania State Senator Vincent Hughes. The Democrat has served the 7th District, comprised of parts of Philadelphia and Montgomery County, since 1994. He's also the Democratic chair of the State Appropriations Committee. State Senator Hughes, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
So let's talk about that work in progress. How close or far apart are the different sides?
Well, comparatively to last year, we're very close. We've got a spending plan. We've agreed upon a budget of about $31.6 billion. Significant compromise from where the governor's original proposal was. We have achieved an agreement that has about a $250 million increase in education spending. Not all that we wanted, but the reality is it's divided government. The Republicans control the legislature, obviously in the governor's office as a Democrat. Now we've got to figure out how to pay for it, which is always the trick. And that's the negotiation that's going on right now. But the tenor of the dialogue is much different than it was last year. A lot of the rhetoric has been rolled back. People are having serious, thoughtful conversations.
But as we contrast with last year, John Baer, a columnist who you know, refers to this as the politics of now. As such, the issues haven't changed. The arithmetic still doesn't work. He posits that the discourse is more civil because it's an election year and the DNC is coming to Philadelphia this month.
Well, I don't know so much that about the DNC. It is an election year. But many of us got the feedback from the public about what happened in the last cycle. They did not like the process and how it played itself out and how political and how hard-edged it got. And as I said, the rhetoric is much different than what it was, all toned down, to try to allow for some, how about if I call it this, some adult conversation to occur.
Talk about your specific role in being a proponent of these adult conversations, mm-hmm. and specifically on this notion of deriving more revenue from gambling. You, for one, are putting up a caution flag.
Oh, we have to be very cautionary about that. It took us many years to come up with a gaming program in Pennsylvania, and it has had a significant benefit. The state takes about 52% off the top for gambling in Pennsylvania. It's one of the highest rates of taxation of any jurisdiction in the country. Most states and cities are only around 5 or 6 or 7%. We drive that into property tax reduction programs and local economic development all across the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
In your estimation, is it also potentially fool's gold to look to revenue from sin taxes, increasing the cigarette tax and expanded availability of wine and liquor?
We've been low on the cigarette tax for quite some time. Relative to other states, of course, in Philadelphia, we have an extra tax on cigarettes, largely to go to the school district. But we don't necessarily like to go to these sin taxes, but you have to look at the environment that we're in right now. This cycle really requires us to use these kinds of resources that are available. I would have much preferred to look at a profits kind of tax, which goes at getting money from those individuals who are doing very well profit-wise, high-end individuals.
Philadelphia and the southeastern Pennsylvania region will be very much in the national and international spotlight in a few short weeks. Is it especially important that lawmakers in Harrisburg come to accord before the curtain opens?
I think it is extremely important. Look, there will be more international attention on Philadelphia in a couple of weeks than we could even fathom in terms of paying for. You couldn't buy this kind of public attention. And we want to make sure that it's positive in every aspect. It's in everybody's best interest to make this a very huge success. And we're going to do that. I guarantee it.
Where will you be during that week?
I'm a delegate. So I'll be in the convention. We are convening a forum with folks from around the nation talking about how we can rebuild urban America. We'll be having some very serious policy conversations, both inside and outside of the Wells Fargo Center.
And hopefully at that point, the budget deliberations will be a thing of the past.
Oh, it's going to be. It better be. Okay.
Senator Hughes, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks
tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
Appreciate it.
Pennsylvania State Senator Vince Hughes. You can hear much more of our conversation at NewsWorks.org. Internet users fear having personal information stolen and then sold to the highest bidder. But what if instead of stolen, those files were locked up, held hostage until you paid hackers to give them back to you? WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports on a growing trend in computer hacking called ransomware.
You're not supposed to be scared to open emails with your professor's name on it. Unless it's a grade. Nope. You're supposed to want to open it and tell you that they're moving a test or something. That was just not what happened.
Last April, 22-year-old Alessia Mattioli from Glassboro opened what she thought was a routine email from her professor. But when she clicked a link in the email, ransomware took over her computer almost immediately.
It started beeping. My computer was beeping. It was going, and the screen went black, and it had all these words, and it was like, your computer's been compromised. You need to call this number.
Mattioli called the number on the screen, which said it would connect her with an Apple technician. But when she got through to the guy on the other end, something didn't seem right.
He was like, we're going to charge you $400 for this, $250 to wipe out your Wi-Fi, then this. It almost was over $1,000. I was like, there is no way this is real.
Ransomware is a type of malicious software that usually comes through email and locks the files in your computer until you pay to have them unlocked. In other words, the hackers hold the stuff on your computer for ransom and won't let that stuff go until they have your money.
These folks are looking to get paid.
Dave Weinstein is New Jersey's first ever chief technology officer. He says that hackers typically operating out of Eastern Europe or Asia usually ask for a few hundred dollars paid in Bitcoin, a difficult to trace digital currency. currency. In some cases, they ask for much more. A hospital in Los Angeles recently forked over about $17,000 to unlock its network.
Ransomware's been around. It's been around for several years. Only in the last year, however, has it become really mainstream. What's changed is the volume of attacks is increasing exponentially, and the tactics are becoming more sophisticated.
Computer security firm McAfee estimates there are nearly 6 million different kinds of ransomware. Last year, New Jersey and Pennsylvania had among the highest rates of cyber attacks in the U.S., according to the Internet Crime Complaint Center. One of those was a ransomware attack that shut down the Swedesboro-Woolwich School District in South Jersey for a few days. Then Superintendent Terry Van Zoren says it knocked out the school's cameras and security system, locked up student and parent information, and even threw a wrench into one of the most coveted parts of the day, lunch.
Kids have passcodes and they punch in and charge their lunch account into which parents prepay. Well, not only could that not happen, our cash registers weren't operational, so we couldn't even open the cash registers if we had been able to get the word out to parents that we did want to go to a cash-only system.
Hackers asked the school district for the Bitcoin equivalent of $125,000. Van Zoren and his colleagues considered it, but decided not to pay.
We're a technology-dependent society, and we take for granted the availability of being able to turn on your PC and check your email and send messages.
The district eventually rebuilt its network, but the whole episode left employees, including Van Zoren, a little bit rattled.
It's hard to get angry when, you know, you don't know where to direct your anger. I would just say, you know, it made us feel somewhat powerless.
Mattioli, the college student who got hacked, also refused to pay, but she got her files back too, thanks to an Apple employee who helped her clean the ransomware off her computer. For many victims, though, the encryption is so complex that the only hope of retrieving the files is to pay up. But that presents a new problem to the less computer savvy among us. How do you even get Bitcoin?
They essentially have customer service to handle that type of situation.
Seth Danbury is president of the Newark-based cybersecurity firm Grid 32.
You have clients that come to us and they're saying, you know, what's a Bitcoin? How do I do this? The organizations that run this, they're pretty sophisticated. They will actually help you acquire Bitcoin and get it to them. They will walk you through. I've seen also them take other forms of payment for people who aren't savvy enough.
Experts say the best defense against ransomware is to back up your files somewhere that is not connected to your computer, an external hard drive or in the cloud. That's especially important to keep in mind this year, when ransomware attacks are expected to be at their highest level ever. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Still ahead this evening, life after prison gets a little bit easier for ex-offenders hosting a new radio show.
It's like when you have a sinus cold and you're all clogged up. It's like when I go in there, it's like I can breathe.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Next month, Philadelphia will have three new FM radio stations, thanks to a hard-fought victory to carve out new space on the dial. These so-called low-power stations will only reach certain swatches of the city, but they'll feature neighborhood-based content, the kind you likely won't hear on commercial broadcasts. WHYY's Aaron Mozell sat down with the hosts of a one-of-a-kind show about life after prison.
So that's you. You're going to introduce that topic? Mm-hmm. Okay. And then who are we going to start with first? That's another thing. Last time we were kind of...
It's Wednesday, and radio activist Vanessa Graber is directing the foursome behind the multi-segment show on WPPM. It will be at 106.5 FM and reach Center City and parts of North and South Philly. The vibe of the show is a bit like The View or The Talk, but less polished and without all the celebrity gossip. Today, the group is recording an episode that will air once WPPM is up and running, but the goal is to do a monthly live show.
I have a question for you guys. Being a strong woman mean to you right now, Faith?
Being a strong woman means to stay focused, remain humble, remain teachable. Being a strong woman means being independent to me, holding my own.
Faith Bartley is in her early 50s. She's rail thin with tight cornrows and an easy smile. She's been out of prison for nearly a decade now. She started selling drugs in North Philly after serving in the Army. Crack, marijuana, PCP, anything she could get her hands on. Then she started using.
I never stole anything from my mom or my family members, but I stole their sleep. She used to send my brother and sister in the crack houses I used to be in. I used to hide behind the door and say, don't tell them I'm here. I'll give you $2. Don't tell them I'm here. And being in the crack house, $2 meant a lot because you're $3 away from getting another piece of crack.
Bartley says things didn't change until her mom died. Then, and only then, was she really ready to start a new chapter.
My mom's remains are cremated on my mantelpiece next to her mother. So every day I reach over in their box and I pray. And I say, girls, I'm going out there. I'm going to do the right thing. I know you girls are proud of me. You know what I'm saying?
The radio show is just another thing that fuels Bartley these days. It keeps her on track. She says it's empowering to have a platform to reach women like her and draw on her life experience to do so.
Who better to speak about recidivism, about being in the penal system, about coming home trying to start all over again and find myself back in it? I'm an expert at that, you understand? So now my expertise lies in the fact that I want to help women break the cycle of recidivism.
Michelle Scales goes by Miss Me on the air. Like Bartley, she did time after being arrested for drug trafficking. She now lives in a halfway house.
And I went through detox at Presbyterian Hospital. So overall, I've been in treatment for 11 months.
Not surprisingly, that period hasn't been easy. Scale says doing the radio show helps.
It's like when you have a sinus cold and you're all clogged up. It's like when I go in there, it's like I can breathe.
And she's feeling like a new person.
I see a lot more in myself than I ever seen in a long time. I know I have potential to do anything that I put my mind to, and that's been so hard for me to say or to fathom in such a long time because I thought I was going to die high.
For activist Vanessa Graber, that's everything. Not only does she hope the show inspires listeners, she thinks recording the programs will prove how far Scales, Bartley, and the others have come.
And hopefully these women will be in a house like the one they dream of. And, you know, that moment in time where they were struggling is recorded in history so that they can, like, look back on it and reflect and kind of see it as a sign of growth.
And perhaps encourage other women ex-offenders to speak up and do the same, even if it's one listener at a time. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Work completed last week on an expanded Panama Canal, allowing larger cargo freighters to slip through the Central American Isthmus. The first time the Panama Canal was excavated, a century ago, the process was documented in paint. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that those paintings are on display at the Michener Museum in Doylestown.
When the French first attempted to carve a 50-mile slice through Panama, it was a battle between man and nature, and man lost. After 20,000 workers died, mostly from malaria, they abandoned the project. And then shortly thereafter, the U.S. took up the same challenge. In 1913, artist Jonas Lee saw an early color film, a documentary about the American effort to create a Panama Canal, and he thought, this is it.
He's interested in the poeticism and the romance, the drama of the construction and sort of this incredible struggle of man against nature.
That is Kirsten Jensen. She's a curator at the Michener Museum in Doylestown. She pulled together 19 paintings by Lee, including images of huge water gates painted bright red and draped in scaffolding, and baskets of concrete delicately lowered on wires down to workers at the bottom of a man-made canyon. Lee came back to New York and exhibited 28 expressive canvases of canal construction. Jensen says the images are less about how the canal was built and more about what it felt like to build it.
I mean, people love this show. When it was first opened, the opening day at Knoedler Gallery in New York, more than 1,000 people saw it, which is a phenomenal number for an opening day for a gallery exhibition.
Unfortunately, nobody wanted to buy them. Lee held on to the paintings for 15 years when they were ultimately bought and donated to West Point. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today from Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.